Good. Well, very nice to see so many people, even as exams loom, which is a testament to the subject and to the reputation of the speakers. I'm Robert Wade. I'm a professor in the Department of International Development here at LSE. And I'm going to follow the law of introducing speakers, which says that the less confident the chair is about the interest in what the speakers are going to say, the longer the introduction of the speakers has to be. And I can almost stop at that point because everybody in this room will know who the two speakers are. Danny Kwar is going to go first. He is Professor of Economics and now, I'm very happy to say, also Professor of International Development, half and half. Half his time is now going to be in my department. And he's going to be speaking somewhat in favor of the question. Danny came to LSE in 1991. In fact, he came as Mervyn King was exiting LSE to be governor of the Bank of England, and Danny came to take over Mervyn King's lectures. However, in the intervening period from 1991 till today, Danny has gone on to many other kinds of subjects, including lots and lots of work on the economics of globalization. Ha-Jun Chang is at Cambridge. He's been on the Faculty of Economics since 1990. He is one of the two, I think this is fair to say, remaining, quote, heterodox, unquote, economists in the Faculty of Economics at Cambridge, practically all of the others having been successfully ejected into marginal departments like the Department of Land Economy or the Judge Institute of Management, but Ha-Jun and Gabriel Palmer remain. So he too will be speaking for about 20 minutes, somewhat questioning the question, and then we will open it to discussion. I just want to say by way of one further point, when I was doing research in the World Bank in 2010, I was very interested at the way that World Bank economists were receiving the ideas of the chief economist of the World Bank, who was Justin Lin, the very first non-G7 chief economist of the World Bank. In fact, he's Chinese, but very importantly, he has a PhD from the University of Chicago. And he was using his position as chief economist to promote what he called new structural economics, which was a kind of a code for industrial policy. And so I was interested in how other World Bank economists, including in his own vice presidency, were receiving these ideas of a more proactive role of the state. And the answer is they were receiving it with great skepticism, which was summed up by one who said, "For every career, there are 100 failures. Who would you put your money on?" And with that, he simply closed down the whole discussion of industrial policy, assuming that industrial policy means doing what Korea did. If you don't do what Korea did, then you're not doing industrial policy, which is a complete nonsense. But anyway, that was the current of thinking in the bank. So, and when he left in 2012, to the best of my knowledge, his ideas of new structural economics left with him. So with that introduction, that's where the wider debate in the world out there is. Danny.
Thank you all very much. It's a great pleasure indeed to be here, to share the stage with two distinguished development economists like this. To get to the question, does market-led development have a future? I have a very simple answer to that. My answer is yes. And then after I answered that yes, I realized I would have nothing more to say for the remaining time that I've got. So I figured I should buttress this out somewhat. So let me take an extreme position to liven things up. I will say that the answer to the question is not just yes, but that indeed, more than that, market-led development is the future. But I want to very quickly amend that position to clarify what I mean by the primacy of the market in this way and what the amendments that I have in mind lie, and in particular, where these amendments lead to problems that in conventional thinking the developing world needs to confront. So having answered yes, I jump to how the common mindset on markets comes with baggage. And a lot of that baggage is inessential at best, but it's actually obstructionist and destructive at worst. Among that baggage are issues that have to do with whether markets, the concept of markets, the practice of markets, are essentially a Western advanced developed economy phenomenon. Are they native only to developed economies? And therefore, when we ask this question, are we actually asking about whether markets, the ideas of markets, need to be exported to developing economies? Put it another way, for the developing world to develop, do they have to become like us? I will argue that market-led development does not need this baggage, and indeed it is by jettisoning this baggage that we can come to a better understanding. But I do think there's a problem, and here's where it is. It is a truism that we live in an interconnected world, and in this world there's some extent distribution of power and political legitimacy. And this is a distribution that informs and conditions global leadership. And where we sit today is the midst of a recession that will not go away. And in this recession, the global economy is desperately seeking sensible world governance. But in this search, we stumble over and over again on a confusion between global leadership and global hegemony, the latter being an idea that ought to be past its sell-by date, but instead is making a comeback. It might never indeed have gone away because it takes different guises. Now, here's the problem. With the deep recession in the advanced economies, confronting a developing world that seems to be going great guns, blame and accusation, others are stealing our jobs, is rife. And economics, my profession, is dangerously re-energizing this call for global hegemony and protectionism. We now are in a world where political leaders look for parochial populist interests for support to seek containment of chunks of the emerging markets. So where I come down on at the end of this is that I will argue that there is now an unholy alliance, an unholy alliance between those who want the best for emerging markets, but argue for want the best for emerging economies, but argue against market-led globalization, an unholy alliance between them who want the best for emerging economies and others who don't, or at least don't care much about developing economies, so long as their own economy does better. And that is the problem. So I want to do this, I want to make this argument in three chunks. I don't have very much time, so I'm obviously going to have to go over this in relatively lightly. But it's useful to say that, although I stand up here as an economist, but I am not obsessed by GDP. I do not think that GDP is the only way by which we're going to measure development. By development, I mean, as I hope I think all of us do, the process of empowering your people so that they feel secure, they are healthy, they are well-nourished, and they have the capacity to pursue goals that advance their well-being. without unfairly disadvantaging others around them, significantly, others who are worse off than themselves. In words, development is about your people having reasonable control over their environment and their destiny. And in this reckoning, for me, freedom from the fear of poverty and starvation is a first step in getting there. Economic growth, cheap talk about GDP, is an essential part of this process, but it is not the only thing. Now, in doing this discussion, I'm going to have to gloss over lots of details. I need to focus on large empirical realities. I want to talk about facts about the world, and I know that there's lots of quibbling we can take over this, but the large set of facts that I want to argue are the set of facts that I think almost all scholars have greater confidence in. So I begin by saying that if we're going to look at this process of empowerment and development, you cannot deny certain basic rules from science and engineering. And science and engineering tell us that what you need to do to empower these people is to put together capital and labor and other factors of production in a way to create value and to create security. You can do that well, or you can do that pathologically. The mix of production factors can bring about creative and productive follow-through, or they can stand idle and die. And for me, what market-led development talks to me about is that you need to leverage these rules from science and engineering. You have to influence how productive factors accumulate, whether it's investment in physical capital or in human capital, in development of skills and capabilities of your people. For me, market-led development means acknowledging a number of things. The importance of incentives in a setting that allows the environment to spontaneously reveal in an emergent way what incentives will produce the greatest good for that individual and for the people around him. And one hopes for society, but that's not really what the critical thing is here. What matters is what's good for the individual, her family, and those around them. Now, included in my picture of market-led development, why I am such a fan of it, is that you put these incentives together with the institution of private property. For otherwise, incentives have nothing to rub up against. Stability matters, because otherwise promised rewards fail to materialize. So I note in passing that I include in this description incentives that reveal the benefits of schooling and building skills, that reveal the returns to investment in machines and in public infrastructure. And a stable environment is needed because these returns only emerge over time. So I summarize my view on markets. You need laws on private property, you need appropriate incentives, and you need a stable environment. And with that, resources are allocated productively, and growth and development in the empowerment sense that I referred to earlier then occur. Now, beyond this, I'm completely agnostic about markets. I'm not a market fundamentalist. I don't think that markets and only markets deliver these outcomes. I'm quite happy to look at alternative mechanisms that proceed with these three criteria. But for me, this is the core of what market-led development means. I don't see the use of proceeding with axiomatic reasoning at this point. I'm going to go look at evidence about the world. And the striking example that I use here is modern-day China. By every account, China, according to the rules that I laid out, has worked out how to implement a market-based economy. In name, it is socialist. It's run by a communist party, but it is a market-based economy in the sense that I've described. And let's look at what's happened in terms of incentives and signals. What has that delivered? Over 600 million people in the last 30 years have been brought out of extreme poverty. China's become a major economic power, growing 40-fold in the three decades following. Per capita incomes have risen 15 times. China has single-handedly driven the global economy. After the global financial crisis, when the rest of the world lay in ruins, China added to the world economy $4.5 trillion at market exchange rates, not in funny purchasing power parity, but $4.5 trillion, three times what the United States economy did. China is driving the world innovation on renewables, on green energy and solar manufacturing. Yes, technologies that are not as sexy as the latest iPhone, but perhaps technologies that will be much more important for the world than what Apple computer delivers to the rest of us. So here is the bottom line where I come out. We're standing up here, you're in this audience, because all of us believe development is a hard thing to do. You can announce that there are these principles that we need to follow, but in practice, it is extremely difficult to implement. The best examples that we've got are where small island economies like Singapore, to some extent, Hong Kong, to a different extent, have been able to follow these rules and principles and achieve an interesting outcome. Development is just plain difficult. It's plain difficult to do in small economies. It's difficult to do, it must be impossible to do elsewhere. But here's the thing then. When you look at China, China is the world's largest country. It's got 1.4 billion people. It is the complete opposite of Singapore in that regard. So when we realize that China, looking over these facts, the world's largest economy, has also racked up the world's fastest growth rates and has been able to sustain the global economy at a time when the global economy lay in ruins, when Western advanced economies could do nothing to mobilize their economy, I, and I think many others, come to the realization that my friend Kishore Mahbubani at the Lee Kuan Yew School articulated. And that is that when you realize what China has done, it is like realizing that... Okay, I'm sorry, the slides are a little bit off. It is like realizing that the fattest kid in school has just won the marathon and had the 110-meter race. Okay. And he's done that through a market-led development process. Now, I've got a little bit more time, so I get to develop my case a little bit more. Most of us are indeed opposed to a simple, naive view of market-led development. Okay. And that's because the rest of my presentation, market-led development comes with a baggage. It comes with an intellectual baggage along the lines that I've already described to you. So let me describe that baggage by saying how the rest of the world criticizes some of the development path in China. One large criticism is that China is rapidly coming up to a middle-income trap. And it's coming up to a middle-income trap for many different reasons. It's invested too much. Its people are going to be too old. Its governance systems are just wrong. Its political system is inflexible. There's a mismatch between its market-led development, its economics, and its politics. It does not have a traditional system of Western-derived liberal democracy. And that is a reason, many people say, that the middle-income trap will catch China. And indeed, when the World Bank reports this, they say of the 120 economies or so that are either poor or middle-income in the 1960s and the 1970s, only 13 have been able to evade the middle-income trap. And these 13 are the ones that have desirable properties. This is an observation made by, among others, Darren Acemoglu and James Robinson in a book, Why Nations Fail, and many other observers. I want to argue against this position. Okay. So the governance mismatch idea says that once you've gotten your economy off of the very bottom, as China did, then what you need are open, inclusive, flexible, and responsive political institutions, usually with some mixture of ballot box democracy, an independent judiciary, transparency, and rule of law, none of which China or other Asian economies display in any great extent. Because otherwise, the system can be manipulated, and it does not take care of its poor, its weak, and its vulnerable. It is democracy that guarantees that. Instead, in China and elsewhere, that do not follow this path of Western-derived liberal democracy, even if they do follow a markets-led development path, the system is manipulable, corrupt extractive elites will emerge, they will disrupt progress, they will distort incentives, they will lead to behaviors that are economically unproductive. Okay. Come away from this. I'm the first to sign up why all of these things are not good things that you want to have in a society. Obviously, corruption is a bad thing. Social injustice, segments of society getting luxury and wealth when they don't deserve it, that's a bad thing. Ordinary people being unable to obtain basic medical care or see redress for wrongs that have been done them because of corruption in the system, that is a bad thing. All of that is deeply unpleasant. All of that ought to be eradicated. And at the same time, meritocracy, accountability, transparency need to be elevated. How does this square with my optimism for Asia following a path that's different from the West, but nonetheless using a markets-led development path trajectory? We need to separate these surface manifestations of malfeasance and misbehavior from the question whether a system, a country, a developing economy can organically grow its own solution to the problem of development without wholesale importing of Western models of liberal democracy. Or the associated but different important question whether liberal democracy is the only possible coupling with markets that delivers sustainability and political legitimacy. I would feel, and I do feel, a lot more comfortable answering yes to this question if we can indeed separate these things. Okay. My first observation in this regard is democracy does nothing for you if you have to vote for a party not because you think it'll do you any good, but because you think the other party is evil. Mm. If civil society is underdeveloped, a freer political system simply means greater instability. And instability is a very bad thing. It is the thing that I referred to earlier about what will make market-led development work. And here I think the test has to be empirical. So let me conclude by reciting a set of differences across societies that have followed different paths of this kind of political engagement. Let me return to China again and compare it with one other economy. So China's per capita income, I said, grew 15 times in the three decades after 1980. But here's the other remarkable fact. Its median wages, its wages at the 50th percentile, doubled every decade. Its inequality, yes, was high, was rising, continues to rise, but in terms of the bottom half of the population, they're better off. By contrast, United States' median wages have declined, not just relatively, but in real absolute value between 1970 and 2007, when you measure them in inflation-adjusted values. This configuration of a Western liberal democracy being unable to take care of its own people, its weak and the bottom part of its population, squares ill with the idea that you need liberal democracy. It's only with that that you're able to take care of the weak in society. Since 1980, China has reduced extreme poverty within it by over 600 million people, more than the entire world combined, 10 times the population of the United Kingdom, 1.5 times the United States or Western Europe. In contrast, in 1980, the share of U.S. income accruing to the top 1% of its population was 10%. By 2007, that share had reached 25%. So where do I come out with this? Pretty much everyone agrees that China can do a lot better. China, for me, is the example of market-led development, but without the political baggage that comes with Western liberal democracy. Yes, extractive elites exist there, fact of life. Here's the other fact of life. Extractive elites exist everywhere. They exist in liberal democracies. They exist in places that are not liberal democracies. I want to argue that market-led development is indeed the future, but where we need to not get tied down to is the idea that there's just one pathway to legitimacy of a regime or of a state. But instead, there are multiple pathways to achieve that. Okay, let me end with an insidious conspiracy theory view of the world. By arguing that emerging economies, even when they follow a market-led development path, a trajectory, but don't check off all the tick boxes about how they are now like us, like Western liberal democracies, okay, this delegitimizes the regimes and the growth trajectory in emerging economies. Why does this matter? This matters because the world now is in a situation where it needs global leadership. Global leadership is needed to provide global public goods, to maintain security in the world, to battle piracy and terrorism, to combat pandemics, to combat global climate change, to write and maintain the rules on international trade and finance. But in this thinking, a number of writers have blamed the weakness of the recovery from the 2008 global financial crisis to be the result of the US diminished influence and the lack of a successor on the world stage. The message there is that we can restore the world to balance if only we restore the position of the United States in its primacy in the global system. Okay. Now, here's an experiment that I want to end with. Go to Hainan Island in the South China Sea and draw a circle 4,000 kilometers in radius. That's the picture you come up with. That's the highlighted region. And here's the fact. That region contains about 25 million square kilometers of land area, with 1/16 of total world land area, 1/6 of total world land area. Okay. In that circle, more than half the world's population lives. More people live in that tiny circle than live outside of. In a system that you believe the primacy of democratic ideals, it is those people who need to determine how the system of global governance runs. But that is not indeed how the world runs. Mm-hmm. The good news is that the world's economic center of gravity, weighted by GDP in different parts of the world, is now rapidly converging to that circle. And if global governance follows economics, just as it follows democratic ideals of the population, that is indeed the new system of global governance that we need to converge to. But what it also means is that it is sharply different from this kind of a world. For most of the last century, the world's political center has sat firmly on the transatlantic axis. More than that, it's sat in just Washington, D.C. So we're rapidly coming to a situation where market-led development in a part of the world that refuses to make friends with the same set of political ideals that we think they ought to have will soon be the world's economic center. The world's economic center will soon be 10 time zones distant from the world's political center. This fractures the world's global economic and political landscapes, and it sets up a tension between how economies perform and what global governance looks like. And we need to repair that fracture. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Just before Ha Jun gives his answer to that question. Let me just press you, Danny, on one thing, which I think will is an effort to clarify what your general argument is. Your general argument is that there are three families of necessary and sufficient conditions for development. You recognize that these are tough to implement, but you do say, as I understood you, these are necessary and sufficient. Namely, one, appropriate incentives, two, private property, three, stability of investment so that rewards accrue to those who, rewards in the future accrue to those who invest today. The point I want to ask you is simply, has this been tested? Have you tested it? I mean, empirically, measuring countries in terms of their degree of private property, their degree of whatever you call appropriate incentives, the danger is that that's a complete tautology, because if it works, then the incentives must be appropriate. If it doesn't work, then obviously the incentives were inappropriate. And so the question is, how can you get out of a tautology?
Okay. We can have a further discussion on this subsequently as well. But let me quickly address your point by saying I don't think these are necessary and sufficient conditions, and I think there are different mechanisms by which we can achieve these lacuna.
Okay. I did hear you say that they were necessary and sufficient. that leaves open the possibility of different ways to reach those necessary and sufficient conditions, which is the point you just made. Okay. So, Hajun.
Yeah. Okay, where's my presentation? There's not much to present in terms of PowerPoint, but let me just get it out. Yeah, very simple. Okay, so yeah, before we begin, I completely agree, Danny, that electoral rules of liberal democracy cannot be the judge of how good the governance system is. That Robert knows about this much better than I do. But I was in Iceland last December, and I was told that the former prime minister and then central bank governor had just instituted himself as the editor of the biggest newspaper. I haven't heard of anything like that, even in a developing country with the corrupt political system. Icelanders tell you that they had the parliament since 1356 or something. But, the reality is quite complex. Anyway, development is a very difficult process. I think it can be described as driving a crapped-out second-hand car with missing parts and running low on fuel with malfunctioning sat-nav system and having fight with your friends where you want to go in the car. So it needs all the help you can get. And, let me make this clear. Markets are the most powerful institutional vehicle for economic progress that humanity has ever invented. So make no mistake about that. But exactly because it is so powerful, we need to properly regulate it. Which country had traffic rules and speed limits when people were riding around in bicycles and horses? It's exactly because we invented cars that we needed to introduce those things. And it's exactly because we started getting these powerful cars that we started building in the ABS brakes and airbags and side impact bars. Because they were driving around in those funny cars in the 1920s, you didn't need those things. So I start from that observation. It's a powerful vehicle, but exactly because it's powerful, it needs to be properly regulated. And markets are means, not ends. This is something that a lot of people say, but I think that it needs repeating. So, answering the question from that point of view, we don't want market-led development in the sense of accepting whatever the market is doing. I don't think that question is necessarily arguing that point, but it's important to repeat that. Yeah, I would accept or even expand markets when they are helping us achieve development or whatever other goals that we are pursuing. But I would say that we should restrain or even shrink them when they are not. So it's a very pragmatic position. Yeah? You know, following the former Chinese leader, Mr. Deng Xiaoping, who famously said that I don't really care whether the cat is black or white as far as it catches mice. Yeah? Now, somehow I got to write a very kind of theoretical reflection on this issue. Maybe it's not so much fun, but let me try to think through this issue of market versus state, the dichotomy that has defined development debate in the last at least 3 decades, huh? Or probably 5 decades if you were in LSE because of Peter Bauer. I would argue that this is a fundamentally misleading dichotomy. Because when you think about it, markets are not actors in the sense that states or firms are. Yeah? It's a set of relationships, yeah? Set of rules. So if you really want to talk about that dichotomy, you have to talk about state-private sector dichotomy rather than state-market dichotomy. Yeah? Because market has no will of its own. Huh? Now, I think even that is not very helpful because the relationship between the state and the private sector is complementary rather than antagonistic. Of course, many economists will tell you that they are when they talk about crowding out, when they talk about the need to deregulate and get the state out and so on. But, you know, in the end, you need a well-functioning state to have well-functioning markets and vice versa. Now, given that markets are not actors, whether we accept markets in particular cases depends on 2 things. First, the rules that define those markets, and secondly, the characteristics of the actual actors that operate in those markets. Consumers and producers. Yeah? And the state actually can be both. Yeah, it is a consumer when it buys things from the private sector. It can be a producer when it produces, police service, social service, commercial services through state-owned enterprises. Yeah? Now, first, let's talk about the rules. Different markets have very different rules on what can be bought and sold, how they can be exchanged, how competition is conducted, how people are compensated, and so on. And these differences exist not just across countries, not just across times, but also across markets within a single country at a particular point of time. So any country contains markets with very different rules. And depending on what these rules are, the results of market-led development can be very different. So, for example, you could introduce a rule that foreigners have to pay taxes to enter your national market. That's called protectionism, tariffs. Or you can introduce a rule saying that we give tax advantage to those who invest in machines rather than, say, houses. Or you can introduce a rule saying that you cannot make these kinds of speculative investments and so on. So, according to these rules, the results can be very different. Huh? Now, which are the right rules? Now, actually, as I argue in this book and elsewhere in more academic papers, these rules cannot be, in the end, chosen through some kind of scientific laws. they are in the end politically constructed. Is there any reason why we shouldn't have slavery in terms of pure economic reasoning? Well, you know, there are these economists who make the so-called libertarian case for voluntary slavery. You know, if I ask Robert to give me, I don't know, £5 million and promise to work as his slave for the rest of my life, you know, he didn't force me. I volunteered for it. Who are you to say that I shouldn't do that? You have £5 million.
I wish.
You know, there was a time when people thought, banning child labor was nonsense, and so on. So, basically, in the end, all these market rules are politically decided. Now, we may agree to pretend that some of them are not politically determined and accept those underlying political decisions for the moment, fine. But if you really go to the end, there is no rule that is not political. No? Now, if there is no scientific theory to tell you where exactly you should draw the boundary of the market, what kind of rules you should have, and so on, what rules you choose depends on what kinds of outcomes they create and what kinds of outcomes you want. Yeah? Once again, you have to be pragmatic. Now, even with, let's get this up now. And even with the same rules, the outcomes of a market process will depend on the characters of the actors in it. Yeah? There are producers and consumers, if you divide them big, and then there are all these different categories of actors. Now, of course, the consumers can make a difference. I mean, consumers demanding more organic or green products have recently changed some markets quite significantly. Many governments have actually significantly changed the course of their economic development by acting as a particular type of consumer through government procurement policy. The Japanese computer industry and the Finnish mobile phone industry would not have existed if the Japanese and the Finnish governments bought these rubbish products from their own national companies for a long time. No, because they were rubbish. But the more important are the producers. Be they government entities like state-owned enterprises or government departments producing certain services, or private sector firms. And two things about these producers, as well as the consumers, matter, and these two things are their motives and their capabilities. First, let's talk about motives. In many societies, we have producers or potential producers that are not interested in long-term investment and productivity growth. Danny actually has given the statistics that I was going to use. Top 1% of Americans taking, instead of 10% as they used to 30 years ago, now taking 25%. Despite that, investment as a share of GDP in the United States has fallen. This is quite a shocking statistic, because the whole justification of trickle-down economics was that you give those people more money so that they can invest more and create more jobs and growth. You pay them 2.5 times more, so to speak, and they are doing even less. This is a problem, to say the least. There are many countries where these kind of things happen. Basically, the supposed investors are not doing their jobs. They are not investing. They are engaged in conspicuous consumption. They are engaged in capital flight. Or when they invest, they are investing in the wrong things. real estate speculation and so on. Now, what do you do when your producers, broadly defined, do not do things that encourage economic development? Well, first of all, you can replace them with other actors. Countries have done that. After the Second World War, quite a few European countries, especially France, nationalized a lot of companies in the belief that their capitalists were particularly undynamic and conservative, and they needed to modernize their industries. And they couldn't just let those guys do it, because they have, well, had failed at least for the previous 100 years to do that. In East Asia, after the Second World War, a lot of countries had land reform and redistributed land from absentee landlords who were not really taking of their land and gave them to more eager small farmers. Now, once again, I mean, this is a pragmatic question, because there is actually quite a strong consensus among economic historians that the Japanese landlord class, until the First World War, actually quite dynamic forces. These people that invested in irrigation, they introduced new seed varieties, they organized small farmers into some kind of working collectives and so on. But when that generation died down, their children all moved to Tokyo and Osaka and couldn't care less about the land. So a lot of people started arguing that this is holding Japanese agriculture back. Anyway, you can do something less radical and leave the existing producers alone, but change the rules of the market. So if you want to enhance increase productivity-enhancing investments, especially in countries like the U.S. and Britain, you need to change rules about corporate takeover, rules about CEO pay, which is totally dependent on how well they serve short-term speculative shareholders.
Arjun, 5 minutes.
No, I'll be okay. Now, how about capabilities? And I mean, this is the more important question when it comes to developing countries. Because in mainstream economic models, it is usually assumed that everyone is equally capable. The best example is Heckscher-Ohlin-Samuelson trade theory. There's the one best practice technology for each product, which uses different factor combinations. Different countries have different relative factor endowment, and they choose one of those technologies according to their factor endowments. Well, they choose things in which they are least bad at. Because people often misunderstand this notion of comparative advantage. Comparative advantage doesn't compare different countries. It's comparing different possible activities. So, when you hear some people saying, oh, such and such poor country doesn't have any comparative advantage in anything, that's wrong. Everyone has comparative advantage in something. You might be rubbish at everything, but there must be something at which you are the least rubbish at. No, this is a very important insight. But in this, in the Heckscher-Ohlin version, because of that assumption of a technology, if Guatemala is not producing BMW, it's not because it cannot, but because it doesn't want to. Because that, according to the law of comparative advantage, it's disadvantageous for Guatemala to produce things like BMW. But in the end, the key problem for developing countries is that their producers are not capable. That's the knob of the problem. So things like infant industry protection tries to create the space in which our producers can increase their capabilities. Not the way I just have formulated it. You know? I'm not saying that protection itself increases capabilities. Yeah, there might be a little bit of increase because there is a learning by doing effect, which comes from cumulative experiences. You know? So if you are protected and have bigger, well, more consumers to serve, you have more production experience and your productivity might increase a bit. Yeah? But that's not nearly enough. You need to invest in productivity enhancing, things like investment in machines, skills, research, and what have you. Yeah?
Arjun, 2 minutes.
Yeah, actually, I'm done. So to summarize, markets are the most powerful institutional vehicles for economic progress. Let's get that straight. But whether we should leave things to the market, as we have been recommended to do in the last few decades, will depend on the exact rules that those markets have and on the motives and capabilities of market actors. And if these rules, motives, and capabilities are inadequate, we should change them. There's nothing sacred about any of these. So in that sense, the term market-led itself is quite loaded, but, insofar as that we use it in the sense that it has been used, my answer to the question is no.
Okay, well, one of the themes that ran through that is about markets, the role of markets and the role of states. And I think both of them would agree that that basic polarity, which is a key part of neoliberal thought, that basic polarity is itself mistaken because it implies that there is a necessary trade-off. More state means less market, more market means less state. And once you embark upon a debate couched in those terms with a necessary trade-off between state and market, then the debate goes nowhere. I think it's much more constructive to think of the state and the market, meaning small and medium enterprises, and number three, giant global corporations, and number four, civil society, and a kind of quadrilateral relationship between them. And then the question is, what is the appropriate configuration of these four kind of entities in terms of producing the process that we call development? And so there are all these kind of issues. But then Danny did talk about something towards the end, and I think we should not lose track of the second big theme. It came out in the context of his analysis, and he's got a great deal of publicity from this analysis about the changing location of the economic center of gravity of the world, moving from the mid-Atlantic in 1980 to somewhere near Turkey at the moment, and going quite quickly in an easterly direction. And then the question becomes, okay, so if this happens in terms of the economic center of gravity, what happens to political power? To what extent is political power, that is, power in the World Bank, in the IMF, in the G20, in the Bank for International Settlements, and the International Accounting Standards Board, and so on and so on and so on, in the UN, to what extent is political power following this trajectory of changing economic weight towards the east, not towards the south, towards the east? So these are two big sets of issues. And begin, do you want to quickly comment on either of your presentations?
No, I mean.
Okay. Well, okay. Maybe I can ask a question.
Yeah.
Not so much comment, but it strikes me that, you know, of the among the many interesting ideas, two planks that you set out, that the market is a very powerful mechanism, and that we need to regulate the market. I think those are two extreme planks that most people would sign up to. And I suppose the real question, whether sort of rubber hits the road between you and me, is where exactly in that the gulf between those extremes rests. And I suppose I'm happy to take the first step at this, and that is that I think, you know, I think market fundamentalism, by which I mean, you know, the idea that you go around thinking that everything that markets do have to be right, and that everything, every time you disrupt markets, has to be wrong. You know, market fundamentalism has no place in the discussion, you know, except as an extreme whipping, except as an extreme poster child of a certain way of thinking. But nonetheless, I do think that the way in which markets provide incentives and the way in which they signal where resources and factors of production and activity is scarce, that is the right mechanism by which we should allow activity to follow. And I wonder if when you say, you know, markets are powerful, therefore we should regulate them, that you even disallow the possibility that markets give the right signal in many instances.
It's an empirical question, isn't it? Mm. So sometimes it gives the right incentives, sometimes it doesn't. But my view is that what is more important is that we need to talk about capabilities more. And I'm not just talking about Amartya Sen kind of individual capability, but social capability, collective capability. Because economists have focused too much on incentives. They have forgotten about the capabilities. You know, I mean, if someone comes to me and says, well, Dr. Chang, if you win next year's London Marathon, I'll give you $50 billion. Yeah? You know, there cannot be bigger incentive. Yeah. Well, I just can't do it, you know. So that we also need to think about ways to raise capabilities, and some of these might require restraining certain parts of the market in the sense that, you know, let me give you a striking example. Back in 1955, all the 12 Japanese car companies put together built 70,000 cars. The same year, General Motors alone produced 3.5 million cars. The United States as a whole produced 7 million cars. So if Japan opened the car market at that time, the Japanese auto industry would have been wiped out. But in the end, I mean, because Japan protected its car producers, in the end the whole world benefited. Because they produced a more fuel-efficient car, they had revolutionized the method of mass production and invented the so-called lean production system and what have you. So, you know, once again, it's an empirical question. I'm not saying that protection always brings that benefit. I mean, it needs to be well designed and the incentive to improve constantly put on the recipients and so on. But I mean, if you can produce something like that by using protections, why not?
Along the same reasoning, the same industry, like you say, you know, the U.S. car industry was once thought to be unassailable, but in the last 10 years, the Chinese car industry, you know, which one might have said they would be in the position of being offered a $50 billion prize and not being able to run a marathon, but they have increased their production ninefold. The Chinese car market now is larger. Chinese car production is larger than all of the United States and Japan. You know, Germany sells more BMWs and Mercedes-Benz in China than it does in Germany.
Yeah, if you go to Mexico, if you go to Argentina, there are lots of Chinese cars.
Absolutely. So, you know, it's I guess maybe they want us to...
is it really the market that started that process. Huh? Because in the beginning, the Chinese government could get a lot of technology transferred from Volkswagens of this world, exactly using the political bargaining power. It was a protected market, so if you want to come and build your cars in joint venture with our producers with lots of conditions, you can do it. So it's a mixture. Yeah? It's not straightforward market. It's not straightforward government intervention. Yeah?
Yeah. And that's the problem about framing the question. Is market-led development, does it have a future? It implies that this thing, market-led, is a clearly defined idea. And the point about Harjun's remark is that the distinction between incentives and capabilities is fundamental, and markets can operate in situations where capabilities are being built up in ways that rig the market or protect the market, but it's still a market. It's not... the producers in that market are simply not exposed to international incentives. They are given some form of protection in order to build capabilities. Yeah. That is a fundamental point about development. Okay, you can tell I've got many dogs in this fight. yes. Yes.
Hi. Firstly, I'm thinking I'm 10 years too late to have jumped on the center of gravity as it went past. But my question was going to be... Why didn't Danny tell us when it was closer? but my question was going to be, so if market rules, and all markets have rules, they're not really free, they're all some rules, as you say, they are rules. If they're set politically, without just using the examples of America as Western liberal democracy and China, what political systems or governance set the best rules? Is there answers to that?
Should we take a
few questions? Let's take several questions. Three. Yes.
Microphone.
Thank you. No. Professor Kwai, you conflated the middle income trap with arguments, political arguments, about whether people want their markets to be run with or without full democracy and civil rights and so on. But aren't there a whole bunch of economic arguments about why you might or might not want to be a middle-income country? It's obvious we don't want to be impoverished countries, but is it even possible for everyone to be a high-income country? And you did mention climate change.
Yeah. Thank you.
And the third one, yes.
It's interesting that the previous speaker talked about climate change. Isn't the problem with market-led economies is that they lack the responsibility or don't appreciate the consequences of what they do? I'll give an example. The chemical industry is a billion-dollar industry. I'm not an economics person or anything. But the problem is that ordinary scientists and ordinary people have realized that the pesticides that they produce is fundamentally causing problems to the ecosystem, and therefore is a direct threat to human existence. Professor, isn't it? Well, sorry, Professor Hung. I mean, why have you not included in this model communities and responsibilities? And I disagree that market-led economies have a future simply because there's too much conflict of interest between ordinary people and basically the globalization.
Okay, would you like to take those three questions?
You go first.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, is there an ideal political system? Well, I don't think so. Well, at least telling from what countries have been doing, I mean, maybe the Scandinavian countries come close to it, but, you know, I mean, first of all, the rich countries that, you know, many of them have become democracies only very recently. Huh? You know, Switzerland gave women vote in 1971, actually 91 if you count these two rogue cantons which are refused to give women votes in local elections until 91. You know, the U.S. Became, well, it probably is still not a democracy, the hanging chad and all that, yeah, but, you know, even disregarding that, I mean, until the civil rights movement, the southern states actually had all these vote qualification requirements, which said that you have to be paying taxes and you have to be literate and all kinds of things, yeah. Australia gave the non-whites a vote only in 1962 and so on. So the history of democracy is actually very short and very kind of fragile. Yeah? And then you have cases like Iceland, which used to rank number 3 in the transparency index and corruption perception index in the whole world. And when the financial crisis happened, that you realize it used to be run like a mafia. Yeah? No, that's the only word I can use to describe what has been going on in the country. Yeah? I mean, Robert will probably back me. Yeah? So, you know, it's a constant struggle. You know, there are people who don't want ordinary people to have a voice. You know, in the old days, I mean, basically, unless you are rich, white male, you couldn't vote. Yeah? Period. So, I mean, it's a constant struggle, and in that sense, we need the citizen activism and community pressures and what have you. Now, I mean, I haven't included those things here because I'm talking about the market. So there's an even bigger framework that I didn't talk about, but this is what I did today. The third. Question that you are right. I mean, the markets take into account only things that they are forced to take into account through laws. Yeah. So you have to set those things right. Yeah. Once again, I mean, it's only a vehicle. Yeah. So, you know, if you are, I don't know, if you give a powerful sports car to someone like me, I'll probably hit 5 people and kill 3 of them. If you give it to Lewis Hamilton, he'll win the Grand Prix and earn a lot of money. So the vehicle really depends on the result really depends on how you use the vehicle, who's using the vehicle, for what purpose. Eh? Okay, I'll leave it there.
Okay, on the question about the world's economic center of gravity, it's not too late. You have to get ahead of the game. Because right now, as Robert said, what we know about the world center of gravity is that in the last 30 years, it's moved 5,000 kilometers from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean to now about the Gulf, the Persian Gulf. So you can get ahead on the game, buy Singapore, get in when the money is still good. Which government set the best rules? I don't think that question can be answered in the abstract. Certainly, my own thinking about when you compare how different countries run markets and run governments, it depends on circumstances. It depends on the development of civil society. It depends on the strength of competing interests and the level playing field that's engendered by a free press. It varies to the level of education in a society. Different things work best at different times, in my view. But the U.S.-China comparison is a nice one because it sharply contrasts two different large models about the way the world should go. And I think that comparison there shows that, you know, the U.S. is actually not in as comfortable a position, or we in the West are not in as comfortable a position as maybe we would like to think. The middle income trap, there was a little bit of an accusation that I had tried to confuse matters by talking about the middle income trap the same time that I made the case that I wanted to about political systems, about the attractions of liberal democracy. Guilty. I did do that. I did conflate that a little bit, and I'm happy to have a longish discussion about middle income trap, about how, you know, it is a real problem in the world. It is a problem in the world that, according to the World Bank, only 13 countries of about 200 have been able to evade. The accusations, for the countries that are trapped in this middle income trap revolve around how they have had governments actually misdirect investment, how the governments have twisted the demographic profile in this society so that there are now too many old people, and how governments have manipulated the exchange rate so that, you know, these countries that are potentially being caught in the middle income trap now have exported too much to the rest of the world, and so they are caught in this bind because the people that they were exporting to before are now no longer importing as much as they used to. Actually, interestingly, all the faults that, you know, many people have identified with the countries that are going to be unable to evade the middle income trap actually have a lot to do with state intervention rather than markets. So maybe that's a case for, you know, pointed on my side about how, you know, markets might be able to evade this. Having said that, however, the case for the countries that have been able to evade the middle income trap is actually not that persuasive. The 13 countries that the World Bank trumpets as the countries that we should emulate. Well, true, 5 of them are Far East Asian economies. They are Confucian-based. They're Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore. And 2 of those countries are small island economies that do follow this incentives rule, but they're also small island economies. And of the other 9, well, 4 are kind of different in peculiar ways. 1 of the 4 is Puerto Rico, another is Mauritius, the 3rd is Equatorial Guinea, and then the 4th is Israel. So they're all different factors about why they might be able to evade the middle income trap. And finally, although the World Bank does not trumpet this particular fact, the remaining 4 economies in the 13 that have evaded the middle income trap are Portugal, Ireland, you guess it, Greece, and Spain. Actually, exactly the 4 economies that are dragging down the Eurozone currently in this sovereign debt crisis that we're going through. So the middle income trap is complicated. There are lots of different things to say about it. However, the point remains, people out there in the emerging world, from Malaysia through all of East Asia, running up to China and beyond, are all deathly afraid of their being trapped in this middle income position. Now, you might say, well, what's so bad about being middle income trapped? Not everybody can be the number one. And I suppose these people would say, fine, but maybe we should have, I don't know, a round robin kind of situation where some of the time the top countries come and see what being middle income country is like, and then the rest of us get to enjoy first world incomes. I think most people want to get into the high-level income situation. Now, I've left for the last the climate change point. And sure, greatest market failure in all of recorded human history. This is really bad news. It's a problem with markets, but I suspect it's a problem that would have emerged whether or not we had markets dictating the outcome of our industrial activity. We remember, for a long time, none of us knew anything about our carbon footprint. None of us knew anything about what was happening in the stratosphere. None of us were worrying about global climate change. It's only very recently that we've had to worry about that. And then having said that, who are the people who are doing the most to try and combat global climate change? Well, China is doing a lot because it sees the incentive that if it doesn't, its economy will be totally fouled up. Who's doing very little? The United States, because right now it's just sitting on a huge amount of shale gas and oil. It's totally redrawn the hydrocarbon map for U.S. economic activity. It has no plans to do anything further on the global climate change front. That's totally dropped off its horizon. But the thing that drives all of these actions is incentives. People have to see what the payoff is to them of taking different kinds of actions. And I think that is the powerful message that I think we should take away with this.
Just before we have the next round, I just want to press you, Danny, a bit more on your core conceptual argument. As you said, there are 3 conditions for economic development: appropriate incentives, private property, and stability. You said that you do not regard these as necessary and sufficient conditions, but you also said that when these 3 are present, growth and development will happen. So I just want to press you, what is the nature of the causal status of these 3 conditions?
Okay.
It is true. No, one of the reasons that I said this is not necessarily sufficient, or I thought I should have said that this is not necessarily sufficient, is that, you know, we see around the world economies like China, actually, where the institution of private property is actually very recent. It certainly did not exist throughout all of the 1980s and all of the 1990s. But what they did was cobble together a system that was sufficiently rich so that if you undertook certain actions, you were the one who got rewarded for that. And I think it is those kinds of mechanisms that, in a shorthand, I say private property and incentives. I'm actually quite relaxed about what we call private property and incentives.
And stability.
But stability, no question. I think that stable systems, stable countries, stable governments are the ones that allow productive activity to occur. Whether they are driven by the state or they're driven by markets, they are the ones that allow people to have reasonable planning horizon, to know that if they plant something, if they put together a factory, if they undertake certain kinds of contractual agreements, that the payoff will be there for them. So I think stability is absolutely key. And the reason that I think that, you know, the usual strictures of Western liberal democracy don't unnecessarily fit for purpose is that in many circumstances they will not necessarily lead to stability.
Okay, so the conclusion I draw is that you do think these three conditions are necessary and sufficient conditions. I don't see any other interpretation.
All right, fine.
Yes.
I mean, I completely agree with you about that no country or no one in the East would want to be trapped in the middle income. They would want to aspire for higher income. I find it quite interesting that you compare the West and China, the US and China, because US, Britain are very old capitalist countries. China is, whatever you say, is obviously a new player, okay? I mean, relative in that sense, I guess. It kind of comes across like the reasons why the US and Britain are not doing really well is because of the fact that they are liberal democracies, so to speak. That's the way it comes across to me when I'm sitting and listening to it. And I don't particularly think that is the reason why the Western capitalist countries are lagging behind. Uneven development always gives you that kind of scenario, if you like. And I would argue that the reason why the West, particularly Britain and US, are lagging behind is when, as always happens, production moves to other countries because of competition and all that. There has been a real lack of initiative and political leadership to be able to really assess that as your main production centers are moving to the East, you have to think about how can you make your country more productive. Rather, there's been a lot of investment, speculation on financial services, which ultimately don't really create value in the sense of what value means. So I'd say that is probably more the reason why the West is lagging behind, and not anything to do with liberal democracy. And by the way, I wouldn't necessarily argue or say that the values which are freedom to speak, free press, all these things, democracy, healthy opposing factions and everything else, for me is a universal right, if you like, that I would prefer as well if the Eastern countries that are doing really well also, you know, as people, civil society argues and fights for those rights because they're not particularly linked to just the West. I mean, that's not how I'd say it.
Okay, thanks. There's a question back there.
Yeah, Professor Chang said, you said that different markets have different rules and that those rules are politically constructed. So they also, I suppose, may be deconstructed. Uh-huh. I mean, when market actors create artificial situations to fight government actions aiming development, I mean, when the market elite have no interest in a country development, what should be done? I mean, what can rules do for us in this situation of political struggle? Mm.
And third question.
Okay. So, Danny, because you mentioned the definition of development, and I think it's quite comprehensive, covering human rights and everything. But when you mention the case of China, it seems that when you measure whether a country is really successful, the only thing I hear is mainly still economics, rather than the other human rights or other things. So I think if we simply comparing China and America, one thing is you say we look at where do people move. So people still want to move to America and live there. So that means economic is still not the only criteria to measure the success. So my question is, do you think that market can really lead to the comprehensive definition you give about development rather than only economics?
Okay, those are three questions. Would you like to take those up? We have to end in about 6 minutes or so, so just be patient.
I cannot believe that the World Bank cited Equatorial Guinea. You know, this country used to have a per capita income of $380 in 1995, hit a huge oil bonanza. Now its income is about $15,000. Yeah, in those that period, it grew at something like 28% per year. Mm-hmm. But, you know, is that development? No, I don't think so. Yeah? Because when people are talking about middle-income trap, they are referring at least implicitly about the inability to upgrade your productive capabilities without some extra luck. Yeah. So, I mean, why has Malaysia
without
been...
Without some extra what?
Luck factor, yeah?
Luck. Oh, luck.
Yeah, luck. Yeah, because
Malaysia
hasn't been able to generate its own ability to kind of produce the next Samsung or whatever. Yeah, so that I think that's quite a misleading exercise. And yeah, very briefly, I have my problem with Danny's point on Confucianism. You know, in the 1950s, people used to say that East Asia doesn't develop because of Confucianism.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, qualification there.
My point was that there are huge problems with that particular, the middle income trap concept.
I agree with your general analysis. But now, different market rules, market rules that can be politically deconstructed. Yeah? And yes, I mean, this is what actually has happened all the time. Yeah. Because if you look at the last three centuries of history of capitalism, through political actions, the boundary of the market has been constantly redrawn. Yeah? And if anything, the sphere of market has been shrinking. Yeah? Because there was a time when everything was for sale. Yeah? Not anymore. Yeah? And it's only because that people fought for these things that we got them. Yeah? And we still have to do that. Now, I mean, the difficulty is that, as you implied, market power spills into political power. Yeah? So when certain section of the economy becomes very rich, they buy up the politician or they become the government, like American financial industry. You know, no, seriously, I mean, half the Treasury secretaries in the last 32 years up to Geithner are from the financial sector. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And two of them from one company, mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs. Yeah? So these people will constantly rewrite the market rules to stifle competition, actually. Yeah? So sometimes you need to actually argue for expanding market forces. Sometimes you need to argue for shrinking market forces. I mean, it all depends on the context and your objective. Now, in the short run, it looks quite hopeless. Huh? But don't forget, I mean, 200 years ago, a lot of people would have called you crazy if you argued for abolition of slavery. Huh? Mm-hmm. 100 years ago, they put women in prison for asking for vote. Huh? You know, a lot of respectable people argue that, when you have your husband, why do you need a vote? Yeah? Or your father or whatever. Yeah? And only 50 years ago, I mean, a lot of the founding fathers of the developing nations of today were hunted down by the British and the French as terrorists. Yeah?
20 years ago, barely, Mrs. Thatcher said that anyone who believes that there will be a black majority rule in South Africa is living in cloud cuckoo land, yeah? Where she was living. So in the long run, these things happen, you know. I mean, it doesn't go straight, yeah? Zigzag, backward, and so on. But these things happen only because people fight for it, yeah?
I think we can take just one more question, yes.
Okay, can I answer?
Okay,
can I answer?
Yeah, Daniel. Sorry.
Did you want to?
Can I answer the last round, Robert?
Did you? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Question about why compare U.S. and China. And again, I'm a bit mischievous when it comes to these things, because I figure that by doing these things in a stark way, we get to draw out general principles. But there are three things I want to say about the U.S.-China comparison. And, you know, first, I'm not saying at all that liberal democracy is at fault for the relative decline of transatlantic access. Far from that. But I am saying, if we ask, does liberal democracy take care of its poor? In the systems that we see in the world where liberal democracy is most entrenched, does it guarantee that it takes care of the poor and the weak and the disadvantaged? Quick answer to that is no. We see that in the example of the United States. Now, there's a whole range of factors why different economies perform differentially, but that's also part of the point, that there's no silver bullet single factor, liberal democracy, market versus state, that will explain differential performance. It's the combination of all those things. But that combination should also give all of us a little bit of humility. That we're not going to go around saying there is one magic thing you need to do to your economy and then, you know, stand back and just watch it grow. It is not. It's a whole combination of things. But it's precisely...
Three things.
It's precisely by looking at these three things that we will get some further insight. Okay. Now, and then finally, on the question about China and whether I have misguided, whether misled people about, you know, when I first started talking about this broad issue of development and then I did the China GDP obsession. I'm not obsessed with China's GDP. Let me point out that, you know, the United States today has a level of per capita income that's six times that of the United States, that of China. China today, in per capita terms, is poorer than the per capita income of nine countries in Africa. To hold up China and say that this has failed because people are not flocking to China, but instead of flocking to the United States, I don't think is an appropriate comparison. There's lots more to do. But I do want to say there are lots of things that are going well for it, and we need to give it proper, we need to properly acknowledge those successes.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more question.
Addressing poverty, one of the commonest ways for addressing poverty, I've just lost my question, has been aid, using aid to help market development in developing countries. And none of the speakers mentioned this as a possible way forward in the moment. So does that imply that aid as a tool to help market development has slipped off your agenda like a lot of others?
Aid, you know, I come from a country which has benefited a lot from aid. You know, I was born in a hospital and they brought to it, born in a country at a house which was built with American foreign aid. Yeah? So I have a lot of time for aid, but let's get it into perspective. I mean, the amount is not going to increase very much. And at the moment, it stands basically only at about one-third the level of remittances sent back home by migrant workers. And even if it triples and matches remittances, it's not going to solve poverty. I mean, poverty can only be solved by development of productive capabilities. I mean, maybe that getting very specific groups out of, you know, very specific type of poverty, I mean, maybe aid has a role in that, but as a general measure of lifting people out of poverty, I think that its role is limited.
Yeah. Let me just say, I agree completely. And when we look at actual concrete examples throughout East Asia, what it is that's most lifted people from poverty, lifted countries, is access to technical expertise, which actually the Japanese allowed through their foreign direct investment into other parts of East Asia, that they were quite open about sharing technologies. And the second thing is market access, being able to sell the goods that you produce elsewhere in the world. So if the world, if the West really wants to help the East, really wants to help the emerging economies, open up your markets. Hmm. That's probably the single most important thing to do.
Okay, I will leave you with just one final thought. If you ask the question, this is really important, if you ask the question how many non-Western countries have become developed in the past 200 years since the Industrial Revolution, then however broadly you define non-Western and country, if you define them broadly enough to include Hong Kong as non-Western and a country, and however broadly you define developed, then the answer to that question, how many non-Western countries have become developed in the past 200 years, the answer is 6, or maybe 7. And it is striking to take your aid point. All of them, if you go down the list, including Israel, have had very large amounts of aid. And secondly, all of them have had lots of external enemies, with the possible exception of Hong Kong. So that, to me, then the third point about them that they have in common is that none of them have followed a strategy of what would be commonly be called, like, for example, in the World Bank, market-led development. None of them. So that is a very sobering thought, I think, on which to end. Thank you very much.